sea level, where they were permitted to study. D-level prisoners were not allowed to study. The authorities rued the fact that they had allowed us study privileges, and Badenhorst was determined to rectify that mistake. Later, after my anger abated, I realized that Badenhorst's crude remark to me at the quarry was a calculated one. He had been brought to Robben Island to restore order, and he had singled out the individual he assumed was the source of the disorder. Like a teacher who takes over a rowdy class, he sought to discipline the student he regarded as the principal troublemaker. Chapter 73. In late May of 1971, a number of men from SWAPO, the South West African People's Organization, an ally of the ANC fighting for independence in Namibia, were brought to the isolation section. They were led by Andimba Tuevo Jatuevo, a founder of SWAPO and a formidable freedom fighter. We learned that they had embarked on a hunger strike to protest their isolation, and we immediately decided to join in. This angered Badenhorst and the authorities, who regarded this as an unacceptable insubordination. Late on the night of May 28th, we were awakened by shouts and fierce knocking on our cell doors. "Get up! Get up!" the warders yelled. We were ordered to strip and then line up against the wall of the courtyard. The warders were obviously drunk and were yelling and taunting us. They were led by a sadistic fellow named Fori, whom we privately called Gangster. It was a bitterly cold night, and for the next hour, while we stood at attention, naked and shivering, our cells were searched one by one. Warders kept up their abuse for the entire time. Toward the end of the hour, Govan experienced severe chest pains and collapsed. This seemed to scare Fori, and he ordered us to return to our cells. The warders searched high and low and found nothing, but the search seemed only an excuse for Fori's sadistic impulses. Only later did we learn that Fori was reputed to have molested prisoners in the general section. The following day, we discovered that the warders had brutally beaten some general prisoners before they came to us, and afterward assaulted Tuevo Jatuevo, who hit back and knocked down the warder who was beating him. Tuevo was severely punished for this. We filed a formal complaint about our treatment, but it was ignored. The incident stands out in my memory, but it was by no means unique. Incidents like it were the rule rather than the exception during Badenhorst's command. We were determined not to let conditions deteriorate entirely under Badenhorst. We smuggled messages to our people on the outside to agitate for his dismissal. At the same time, we resolved to create a delegation among ourselves to see Badenhorst. We discussed this for months and gradually decided on its composition. Walter and I represented the ANC, and each of the other parties had two representatives as well. Badenhorst agreed to meet us, and at our parley we threatened work stoppages, go slows, hunger strikes, every weapon at our disposal, unless he reformed his ways and restored many of the privileges that he had rescinded. He merely said he would take what we said under consideration. We regarded this confrontation as a victory, for he was wary of us and knew that we had alerted people on the outside of our complaints. These efforts soon produced a response. A few weeks later, we knew an important visit must be imminent, because when it rained that day at the quarry, we were allowed to take shelter instead of continuing to work. The following day, we were informed that a troika of judges were coming to the island. The authorities asked us to nominate a spokesman to express our grievances, and I was chosen. As I was preparing for my meeting with the judges, I was informed by a reliable source that a prisoner in the general section had recently been severely beaten by a guard. The three judges were Justices Jan Stein, M. E. Theron, and Michael Corbett of the Cape Provincial Division of the Supreme Court. They were escorted by the Commissioner of Prisons, General Stein, and accompanied by Colonel Badenhorst. I met them that day outside, where we were working. General Stein introduced me to the judges and explained that I had been selected to represent the other prisoners. The judges then indicated that as a matter of course they would talk with me privately. I replied that I had nothing to hide, and that in fact I welcomed the presence of General Stein and the colonel. I could see that they were taken aback by my statement, and I added that it would be only proper for them to have the opportunity to reply to my charges. The judges reluctantly acquiesced. I began by recounting the recent assault in the general section. I told them the details that had been reported to me, the viciousness of the beating and the cover-up of the crime. I had barely begun to speak when I noticed Badenhorst shifting uncomfortably. When I had finished describing the incident, Badenhorst interjected in a gruff, aggressive manner, "Did you actually witness this assault?" I replied calmly that I had not, but that I trusted the people who had told me of it. He snorted and wagged his finger in my face. "Be careful, Mandela," he said. "If you talk about things you haven't seen, you will get yourself in trouble. You know what I mean." I ignored Badenhorst's remarks and turned to the judges and said, "Gentlemen, you can see for yourselves the type of man we are dealing with as commanding officer. If he can threaten me here, in your presence, you can imagine what he does when you are not here." Judge Corbett then turned to the others and said, "The prisoner is quite right." I spent the remainder of the meeting enumerating complaints about our diet, work, and studying. Inwardly, Badenhorst must have been fuming, but outwardly he seemed chastened. At the end of the session, the judges thanked me, and I bade them goodbye. I have no idea what the judges said or did after the meeting, but over the next few months, Badenhorst seemed to have his hands tied. The harshness abated, and within 3 months of the judge's visit, we received word that Badenhorst was to be transferred. A few days before Badenhorst's departure, I was called to the main office. General Stein was visiting the island and wanted to know if we had any complaints. Badenhorst was there as I went through a list of demands. When I had finished, Badenhorst spoke to me directly. He told me that he would be leaving the island and added, "I just want to wish you people good luck." I do not know if I looked dumbfounded, but I was amazed. He spoke these words like a human being and showed a side of himself we had never seen before. I thanked him for his good wishes and wished him luck in his endeavors. I thought about this moment for a long time afterward. Badenhorst had perhaps been the most callous and barbaric commanding officer we had had on Robben Island. But that day, in the office, he had revealed that there was another side to his nature, a side that had been obscured, but that still existed. It was a useful reminder that all men, even the most seemingly cold-blooded, have a core of decency, and that if their heart is touched, they are capable of changing. Ultimately, Badenhorst was not evil. His inhumanity had been foisted upon him by an inhuman system. He behaved like a brute because he was rewarded for brutish behavior. Chapter 74. It was announced that Colonel Willemse would succeed Colonel Badenhorst as commanding officer. I requested a meeting with the colonel after his appointment and visited with him shortly after his arrival. While he was obviously not a progressive man, he was courteous and reasonable, in marked contrast to his predecessor. Badenhorst's tenure, we hoped, would simply be a dip on the graph of the steady improvement of our conditions. The aggressive young warders departed with Badenhorst as well, and we quickly resumed our customary behavior at the quarry and in our section. Willemse may have been a reasonable man, but when he saw that we spent more time at the quarry talking than working, he was shocked. He had been on the island for only a few weeks when I was summoned to his office for a meeting. "Mandela," he said frankly, "you must help me." I asked him how. "Your men are not working. They don't listen to orders. They only do what they want to do. This is a prison. There must be some discipline. It is not only good for us, but good for you. We must have some order, or they will bring back someone like the previous head of prison." What the colonel said made sense. I listened and told him that his request was a legitimate one. But before I could respond to him, I would need to meet with all my men. At that time, a meeting of all prisoners in the single cells was something that was expressly forbidden. By asking him to permit such a meeting, I was asking him for a significant extension of the rules. He knew this as well as I did, and he wanted some time to consider it. Within days, I received a communication from Willemse saying he would not allow it. All of us met one afternoon in the courtyard, without guards watching over us. I told the men what Willemse said, and noted that by compromising a bit now, we would be making our conditions better in the long run. We decided that we would at least appear to be working, but what work we did would be at a pace that suited us. From then on, that is what we did, and we heard no more complaints from the commanding officer. During the early part of Willemse's tenure, in 1971 and 72, there was a steady influx of captured MK soldiers. These men had seen combat and were well informed about the state of the exile movement. While I was never happy to see ANC men imprisoned, I was keen to debrief them after they arrived. I was extremely eager to know about Oliver, about the training camps, about MK's successes and failures. The men were extremely militant, and they did not take to prison life easily. One of the first of these men was Jimmy April, an MK officer who had trained under Joe Slovo and had fought against the enemy in Rhodesia. MK had been slowly infiltrating men back into the country with forged identity documents. Jimmy had been one of them, and he was arrested in South Africa. Jimmy regaled us with war stories, but I also took him aside and asked him about MK's problems. As I was founder of MK and its first commander-in-chief, Jimmy and the others were more candid with me than they were with the others. He told me stories of discontent in the camps and of abuses by MK officers. I asked him to keep the matter to himself, and I managed to smuggle a letter out to Oliver suggesting that some reforms must be made in the camps. One day, I was at the head office meeting with Colonel Willemse when I saw Jimmy outside the office of another official. He turned to me and said in some agitation, "They are refusing to give me my letter." "On what ground?" I replied. "They claim it contains matter which I am not allowed to see," he said. I entered the office to discuss the matter, but before I could even open my mouth, Jimmy had barged in and loudly said to the official, "Give me my letter." Jimmy began to push me aside to get to the officer's desk and take the letter himself. At this point, the official took the letter and moved behind me as if for protection from Jimmy. It might have been a comical scene in a film, but at the time it was nerve-wracking. I turned to Jimmy and said quietly but sternly, "Please don't do this. Calm down. I'll sort out this matter and see to it that you get your letter. Now please leave." My speech had the intended effect, and Jimmy left the office. I then turned to the officer, who was extremely rattled. It was, for me, an odd position. I was not opposing the authorities, but mediating between my own people and the men I had so long fought against. The militancy of those who were coming to the island put me in this position more and more frequently. While we were encouraged by their radicalism, these men sometimes made our day-to-day life more burdensome. Within a week, the officer handed me Jimmy's letter. Chapter 75. One morning, instead of walking to the quarry, we were ordered into the back of a truck. It rumbled off in a new direction, and 15 minutes later, we were ordered to jump out. There, in front of us, glinting in the morning light, we saw the ocean, the rocky shore, and in the distance, winking in the sunshine, the glass towers of Cape Town. Although it was surely an illusion, the city, with Table Mountain looming behind it, looked agonizingly close, as if one could almost reach out and grasp it. The senior officer explained to us that we had been brought to the shore to collect seaweed. We were instructed to pick up the large pieces that had washed up on the beach and wade out to collect seaweed attached to rocks or coral. The seaweed itself was long and slimy and brownish green in color. Sometimes the pieces were 6 to 8 feet in length and 30 pounds in weight. After fishing out the seaweed from the shallows, we lined it up in rows on the beach. When it was dry, we loaded it into the back of the truck. We were told it was then shipped to Japan, where it was used as a fertilizer. The work did not seem too taxing to us that day, but in the coming weeks and months we found it could be quite strenuous. But that hardly mattered because we had the pleasures and distractions of such a panoramic tableau. We watched fishing ships trawling, stately oil tankers moving slowly across the horizon. We saw gulls spearing fish from the sea and seals cavorting on the waves. We laughed at the colony of penguins, which resembled a brigade of clumsy, flat-footed soldiers. And we marveled at the daily drama of the weather over Table Mountain, with its shifting canopy of clouds and sun. In the summer, the water felt wonderful, but in winter, the icy Benguela currents made wading out into the waves a torture. The rocks on and around the shore were jagged, and we often cut and scraped our legs as we worked. But we preferred the sea to the quarry, although we never spent more than a few days there at a time. The ocean proved to be a treasure chest. I found beautiful pieces of coral and elaborate shells, which I sometimes brought back to my cell. Once someone discovered a bottle of wine stuck in the sand that was still corked. I'm told it tasted like vinegar. Jeff Massimola of the PAC was an extremely talented artist and sculptor, and the authorities allowed him to harvest pieces of driftwood, which he carved into fantastic figures, some of which the warders offered to buy. He constructed a bookcase for me, which I used for many years. The authorities told visitors that they had provided me with it. The atmosphere at the shore was more relaxed than at the quarry. We also relished the seaside because we ate extremely well there. Each morning when we went to the shore, we would take a large drum of fresh water. Later, we would bring along a second drum, which we would use to make a kind of Robben Island seafood stew. For our stew, we would pick up clams and mussels. We also caught crawfish, which hid themselves in the crevices of rocks. Capturing a crawfish was tricky. One had to grab it firmly between its head and tail, or it would wiggle free. Abalone, or what we call pearlmone, was my favorite dish. Abalones are mollusks that cling tenaciously to rocks, and one has to pry them loose. They are stubborn creatures, difficult to open, and if they are the slightest bit overcooked, they are too tough to eat. We would take our catch and pile it into the second drum. Wilton Mkwai was the chef among us, and he would concoct the stew. When it was ready, the warders would join us, and we would all sit down on the beach and have a kind of picnic lunch. In 1973, in a smuggled newspaper, we read about the wedding of Princess Anne and Mark Phillips, and the story detailed the bridal luncheon of rare and delicate dishes. The menu included mussels, crawfish, and abalone, which made us laugh. We were dining on such delicacies every day. One afternoon, we were sitting on the beach eating our stew when Lieutenant Terblanche, who was then head of prison, made a surprise visit. We quickly pretended to be working, but we had not fooled him. He soon discovered the second drum containing a mussel stew bubbling over the fire. The lieutenant opened the pot and looked inside. He then speared a mussel, ate it, and pronounced it tasty. Chapter 76. In the struggle, Robben Island was known as the university. This is not only because of what we learned from books, or because prisoners studied English, Afrikaans, art, geography, and mathematics, or because so many of our men, such as Billy Nair, Ahmed Kathrada, Mike Dingaki, and Eddie Daniels, earned multiple degrees. Robben Island was known as the university because of what we learned from each other. We became our own faculty with our own professors, our own curriculum, our own courses. We made a distinction between academic studies, which were official, and political studies, which were not. Our university grew up partly out of necessity. As young men came to the island, we realized that they knew very little about the history of the ANC. Walter, perhaps the greatest living historian of the ANC, began to tell them about the genesis of the organization and its early days. His teaching was wise and full of understanding. Gradually, this informal history grew into a course of study, constructed by the high organ which became known as Syllabus A, involving 2 years of lectures on the ANC and the liberation struggle. Syllabus A included a course taught by Kathy, a history of the Indian struggle. Another comrade added a history of the colored people. Mac, who had studied in the German Democratic Republic, taught a course in Marxism. Teaching conditions were not ideal. Study groups would work together on the quarry and station themselves in a circle around the leader of the seminar. The style of teaching was Socratic in nature. Ideas and theories were elucidated through the leaders asking and answering questions. It was Walter's course that was at the heart of all the education on the island. Many of the young ANC members who came to the island had no idea that the organization had even been in existence in the 1920s and 1930s. Walter guided them from the founding of the ANC in 1912 through to the present day. For many of these young men, it was the only political education they had ever received. As these courses became known in the general section, we began to get queries from our men on the other side. This started what became a kind of correspondence course with the prisoners in the general section. The teachers would smuggle lectures over to them, and they would respond with questions and comments. This was beneficial for us as well as for them. These men had little formal education, but a great knowledge of the hardships of the world. Their concerns tended to be practical rather than philosophical. If one of the lectures stated that a tenet of socialism is from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, we might receive a question back that said, "Yes, but what does that mean in practice? If I have land and no money, and my friend has money but no land, which of us has a greater need?" Such questions were immensely valuable and forced one to think hard about one's views. For a number of years, I taught a course in political economy. In it, I attempted to trace the evolution of economic man from the earliest times up to the present, sketching out the path from ancient communal societies to feudalism to capitalism and socialism. I am by no means a scholar and not much of a teacher, and I would generally prefer to answer questions than to lecture. My approach was not ideological, but it was biased in favor of socialism, which I saw as the most advanced stage of economic life then evolved by man. In addition to my informal studies, my legal work continued. I sometimes considered hanging a shingle outside my cell, because I was spending many hours a week preparing judicial appeals for other prisoners. Though this was forbidden under prison service regulations, prisoners from all different political stripes sought my help. South African law does not guarantee a defendant the right to legal representation, and thousands upon thousands of indigent men and women went to prison every year for lack of such representation. Few Africans could afford a lawyer, and most had no choice but to accept whatever verdict the court handed down. Many men in the general section had been sentenced without benefit of counsel, and a number of them sought me out to make an appeal. For most of these men, it was the first time they had ever dealt with an attorney. I would receive a smuggled note from a prisoner in F or G asking for help. I would then request the particulars of the case, the charge, the evidence, and the testimony. Because of the clandestine nature of these exchanges, information would come slowly in bits and pieces. A consultation that would last no more than half an hour in my old Mandela and Tombo office might take a year or more on the island. I advised my clients to write a letter to the registrar of the Supreme Court asking for a record of their case. I told the prisoner to inform the registrar that he had limited funds and would like the record at no charge. Sometimes the registrars were kind enough to supply that material gratis. Once I had the record of the case, I could put together an appeal, usually based on some judicial irregularity such as bias, incorrect procedure, or insufficient evidence. I drafted a letter to the judge or magistrate in my own handwriting and then sent it to the other side. Because it was a violation of regulations for me to prepare a man's case, I would instruct the prisoner to copy the document in his own hand. If he could not write, and many prisoners could not, I told him to find someone who could. I enjoyed keeping my legal skills sharp, and in a few cases verdicts were overturned and sentences reduced. These were gratifying victories. Prison is contrived to make one feel powerless, and this was one of the few ways to move the system. Often I never met the man I worked for, and sometimes, out of the blue, a man who was serving us pap for lunch would whisper a thank you to me for the work I had done on his behalf. Chapter 77. The oppression of my wife did not let up. In 1972, security policemen kicked down the door of 8115 Orlando West. Bricks were hurled through the window. Gunshots were fired at the front door. In 1974, Winnie was charged with violating her banning orders, which restricted her from having any visitors apart from her children and her doctor. She was then working at a lawyer's office, and a friend brought Zini and Zinzi to see her during her lunch hour. For this, Winnie was charged and then sentenced to 6 months imprisonment. She was put in Kroonstadt prison in the Orange Free State, but her experience there was not as horrendous as her previous stay in Pretoria. Winnie wrote to me that she felt liberated in prison this time, and it served to reaffirm her commitment to the struggle. The authorities permitted Zinzi and Zini to visit her on Sundays. When Winnie was released in 1975, we managed, through letters and communications with our lawyers, to work out a plan for me to see Zinzi. Prison regulations stated that no child between the ages of 2 and 16 may visit a prisoner. When I went to Robben Island, all my children were in this legal limbo of age restrictions. The reasoning behind the rule is not pernicious. The lawmakers presumed that a prison visit would negatively affect the sensitive psyches of children. But the effect on prisoners was perhaps equally damaging. It is a source of deep sorrow not to be able to see one's children. In 1975, Zinzi turned 15. The plan was for her mother to alter Zinzi's birth documents to show that the girl was turning 16, not 15, and therefore able to see me. Birth records are not kept in a very uniform or organized way for Africans, and Winnie found that it was not hard to modify her documents to show that Zinzi was born a year earlier. She applied for a permit, and it was approved. A few weeks before Zinzi's scheduled visit in December, I had a previously arranged visit with Winnie's mother. When I was seated across from her in the visiting area, I said to her, "Well, Ma, I'm very excited because I'm going to see Zinzi." My mother-in-law, who was a former teacher, regarded me with some surprise and then said in a rather peevish way, "No, Zinzi cannot come and see you because she is not yet 16. I realized immediately that no one had told her about our gambit. There was a warder behind each of us, and I decided I would simply gloss over what she had said and mumbled, "Ah, well, Ma, it is nothing." But my mother-in-law is a stubborn woman, and she did not let it pass. "Well, Kanyansi," an affectionate term for son-in-law in Xhosa, which is what she always called me, "you have made a serious error because Zinzi is only 15. I widened my eyes in a gesture of alarm, and she must have gotten the message because she did not mention Zinzi again. I had not seen Zinzi since she was 3 years old. She was a daughter who knew her father from old photographs rather than memory. I put on a fresh shirt that morning and took more trouble than usual with my appearance. It is my own vanity, but I did not want to look like an old man for my youngest daughter. I had not seen Winnie for over a year, and I was gratified to find that she looked well. But I was delighted to behold what a beautiful woman my youngest daughter had become, and how closely she resembled her equally beautiful mother. Zinzi was shy and hesitant at first. I am sure it was not easy for her, finally, to see a father she had never really known, a father who could love her only from a distance, who seemed to belong not to her, but to the people. Somewhere deep inside her she must have harbored resentment and anger for a father who was absent during her childhood and adolescence. I could see right away that she was a strong and fiery young woman like her own mother had been when she was Zinzi's age. I knew she would be feeling uncomfortable, and I did my best to lighten the atmosphere. When she arrived, I said to her, "Have you met my guard of honor?" gesturing to the warders who followed me everywhere. I asked her questions about her life, her schooling, and her friends, and then tried to take her back to the old days that she barely remembered. I told her how I often recalled Sunday mornings at home when I dandled her on my knee, while Mum was in the kitchen making a roast. I recollected small incidents and adventures in Orlando when she was a baby, and how she had rarely cried even when she was small. Through the glass, I could see her holding back her tears as I talked. The one tragic note of the visit was when I learned from Winnie that Bram Fischer had died of cancer shortly after being let out of prison. Bram's death affected me deeply. Although the government left no fingerprints on Bram's body, it was the state's relentless harassment of him that brought on the final illness that took him too soon. They hounded him even after death. The state confiscated his ashes after his cremation. Bram was a purist, and after the Rivonia trial, he decided he could best serve the struggle by going underground and living the life of an outlaw. It burdened him that the men whom he was representing in court were going to prison while he lived freely. During the trial, I advised Bram not to take this route, stressing that he served the struggle best in the courtroom, where people could see this Afrikaner son of a judge president fighting for the rights of the powerless. But he could not let others suffer while he remained free. Like the general who fights side by side with his troops at the front, Bram did not want to ask others to make a sacrifice that he was unwilling to make himself. Bram went underground while out on bail and was captured in 1965 and sentenced to life imprisonment for conspiracy to commit sabotage. I had tried to write him in prison, but regulations forbade prisoners from corresponding with each other. After he had been diagnosed with cancer, a newspaper campaign calling for his release on humanitarian grounds had influenced the government. It was just a few weeks after the authorities released him, still under house arrest, to his brother's house in Bloemfontein, that he died. In many ways, Bram Fischer, the grandson of the Prime Minister of the Orange River Colony, had made the greatest sacrifice of all. No matter what I suffered in my pursuit of freedom, I always took strength from the fact that I was fighting with and for my own people. Bram was a free man who fought against his own people to ensure the freedom of others. A month after this visit, I received word from Winnie that her most recent request for a visit had been turned down by the authorities on the absurd grounds that I did not wish to see her. I immediately made an appointment with Lieutenant Prinz, who was then head of prison, to lodge a protest. Prinz was not what one would call a sophisticated man. When I went in to see him, I explained the situation evenly and without animosity. But I said the situation as it stood was unacceptable, and my wife must be permitted to visit. Prinz did not appear to be listening, and when I had finished, he said, "Ag, Mandela, your wife is only seeking publicity." I told him that I resented his remark, And before I had even finished, he uttered something so offensive and uncomplimentary about my wife that I immediately lost my temper. I rose from my chair and started to move around the desk toward the lieutenant. Prinz began to retreat, but I soon checked myself. Instead of assaulting him with my fists, as I felt like doing, I pummeled him with words. I am not a man who approves of oaths or curses, but that day I violated my own principle. I finished by telling him that he was a contemptible man without honor, and that if he ever repeated those same words, I would not hold myself back as I had that day. When I had finished, I turned and stormed out of his office. As I was leaving, I saw Kathy and Eddie Daniels outside, but I did not even greet them as I walked back to my cell. Even though I had silenced Prinz, he had caused me to violate my self-control, and I consider that a defeat at the hands of my opponent. After breakfast the following morning, two warders entered my cell and said I was wanted at the head office. When I reached the office, I was surrounded by a half-dozen armed warders. Off to one side was Lieutenant Prinz, and in the center of this circle was a warrant officer who was the prison prosecutor. The atmosphere was tense. "Well, Mandela," the prosecutor said, "I hear you had yourself a nice time yesterday, but today will not be so pleasant. I am charging you for having insulted and threatened the head of prison. It is a grave charge." He then handed me the summons. "Do you have anything to say?" he asked. "No," I replied. "You can speak with my attorney." I then asked to be taken back to my cell. Prinz did not say a word. I knew immediately what I would do. Prepare a countersuit charging everyone from the lieutenant all the way up to the Minister of Justice with misconduct. I would indict the prison system as a whole as a racist institution that sought to perpetuate white supremacy. I would make the case a cause célèbre and make them regret they had ever charged me in the first place. I asked George Bezos to represent me, and a meeting was soon arranged. Before George's visit, I informed the authorities that I would be giving him written instructions. They asked me why, and I replied frankly that I assumed the consultation room was bugged. The authorities then refused permission for me to give a written statement. I must make an oral one. I told them that they had no right to withhold permission, and the fact that they did only confirmed my suspicions. The truth was that the authorities were afraid George would leak a written statement to the press. This was indeed part of our strategy. They were also concerned that I was using George as a conduit to communicate with Oliver in Lusaka, and assumed that the written statement would contain sensitive information. I had previously used George for such purposes, but the document in question did not contain such material. A date was set for the island's disciplinary court, and a magistrate from Cape Town was assigned. A day before the hearing, I was told that my attorney would be arriving the following day, and I would be free to give him my written statement. I met George at the head office in the morning, and we briefly consulted before court was called into session. But the hearing had no sooner started than the prosecutor announced that the prison was withdrawing its case. The judge gavelled the session to a close and abruptly left the room. George and I looked at each other in surprise and congratulated one another on an apparent victory. I was putting away my papers when another warrant officer came over and, pointing to my written statement, said, "Hand me that file." I refused, saying it was a confidential matter between myself and my attorney. I called over the prosecutor and said, "Inform this man that these documents are protected by attorney-client privilege, and that I do not have to turn them over." The prosecutor replied that they were, but that the case was over. Court was no longer in session, and the only authority in the room was that of the warrant officer. The officer plucked the document off the table. There was nothing I could do to stop him. I believe the authorities dropped the case simply to get hold of that document, which, as they discovered, contained nothing they did not already know. As unlikely a prospect as it may have seemed, I nevertheless thought about escape the entire time I was on the island. Mac Maharaj and Eddie Daniels, both brave and resourceful men, were always hatching plans and discussing possibilities. Most were far too dangerous, but that did not stop us from considering them. We had made certain advances. Jeff Massimola, our master craftsman, had managed to make a pass key that unlocked most of the doors in and around our section. One day, a warder had left his key on the desk in the office at the end of our corridor. Jeff took a piece of soap and made an imprint of the key. Using that outline, he took a piece of metal and filed it into the shape of the key. This key gave us access to some of the storerooms behind our cells, as well as to the isolation section. But we never used it to leave our section. It was the sea, after all, that was the uncrossable moat around Robben Island. In 1974, Mac had an idea how to cross that barrier. He had recently been taken to the dentist in Cape Town and discovered that the dentist himself was related by marriage to a well-known political prisoner. The dentist was sympathetic. He had refused to treat Mac unless Mac's leg irons were first removed. Mac had also noticed that the window in the dentist's second-floor waiting room was just a short drop to a small side street where we might make a run for it. When Mac returned, he met with a few of us and urged us to make appointments at the dentist. We did so and learned that a day had been arranged for Mac, Wilton Umkwaye, me, and one other prisoner to go to Cape Town. The three of us were willing to make the attempt, but when Mac contacted the fourth man, he refused. We had doubts about this man's loyalty, and it concerned me that he knew what we were planning. The three of us were taken by boat to Cape Town, and then to the dentist's office under heavy guard. All three of us had trained as soldiers, and we probably had the best chance of actually executing an escape. Mac was also carrying a knife and was prepared to use it. At the dentist's office, the guards first cleared away all the other patients. We demanded to have our leg irons removed, and with the support of the dentist, our guards took them off. Mac led us over to the window and pointed out the street that was our escape route. But something about the street bothered Mac as soon as he saw it. We were in the center of Cape Town in the middle of the day, and yet the street was empty. When he had been here before, the street had been filled with traffic. "It's a setup," Mac whispered. I, too, had the sense that something was not right, and I agreed with Mac. Wilton, whose adrenaline was flowing, said Mac was talking nonsense. "Madiba, you're losing your nerve," he said. But I agreed with Mac, and the three of us simply ended up having our teeth examined. The dentist was curious as to why I had come, because my teeth were fine. While Mac considered the most practical escape plans, Eddie Daniels hatched the most imaginative ones. During the early years, airplanes were not permitted to fly over the island. But by the mid-1970s, we noticed that not only were planes flying over our heads, but helicopters on their way to and from the tankers that sailed off the coast. Eddie came to me with a plan that would involve the organization using a helicopter, painted with the South African military colors, to pick me up on the island and then deposit me on the roof of a friendly foreign embassy in Cape Town, where I would seek asylum. It was not an ill-conceived plan, and I told Eddie he should smuggle out the suggestion to Oliver in Lusaka. Eddie did manage to get his idea to Lusaka, but we never received a response. Chapter 78. Birthday celebrations were bare-bones affairs on Robben Island. In lieu of cake and gifts, we would pool our food and present an extra slice of bread or cup of coffee to the birthday honoree. Fikele Bam and I were born on the same date, July 18th, and I would save a few sweets that I had purchased at Christmas for the two of us to share on our mutual anniversary. My 50th birthday had passed without much notice in 1968, but in 1975, when I turned 57, Walter and Kathy approached me with a long-term plan that would make my 60th birthday more memorable. One of the issues that always concerned us was how to keep the idea of the struggle before the people. During the previous decade, the government had silenced most of the radical press, and there remained a prohibition on publishing the words or pictures of any banned or imprisoned individuals. An editor could go to jail and his newspaper be shuttered for publishing so much as a snapshot of me or my colleagues. One day, Kathy, Walter, and myself were talking in the courtyard when they suggested that I ought to write my memoirs. Kathy noted that the perfect time for such a book to be published would be on my 60th birthday. Walter said that such a story, if told truly and fairly, would serve to remind people of what we had fought and were still fighting for. He added that it could become a source of inspiration for young freedom fighters. The idea appealed to me, and during a subsequent discussion, I agreed to go ahead. When I decide to do something, I like to start immediately, and I threw myself into this new project. I adopted a rather unorthodox work schedule. I would write most of the night and sleep during the day. During the first week or two, I would take a nap after dinner, awake at 10 o'clock, and then write until it was time for breakfast. After working at the quarry, I would then sleep until dinner, and the process would begin again. After a few weeks of this, I notified the authorities that I was not feeling well and would not be going to the quarry. They did not seem to care, and from then on I was able to sleep most of the day. We created an assembly line to process the manuscript. Each day I passed what I wrote to Kathy, who reviewed the manuscript and then read it to Walter. Kathy then wrote their comments in the margins. Walter and Kathy have never hesitated to criticize me, and I took their suggestions to heart, often incorporating their changes. This marked-up manuscript was then given to Lalu Chiba, who spent the next night transferring my writing to his own almost microscopic shorthand, reducing 10 pages of foolscap to a single small piece of paper. It would be Mac's job to smuggle the manuscript to the outside world. The warders grew suspicious. They went to Mac and said, "What is Mandela up to? Why is he sitting up late at night?" But Mac merely shrugged his shoulders and said he had no idea. I wrote rapidly, completing a draft in 4 months. I did not hesitate over choosing a word or phrase. I covered the period from my birth through the Rivonia trial and ended with some notes about Robben Island. I relived my experiences as I wrote about them. Those nights, as I wrote in silence, I could once again experience the sights and sounds of my youth in Kunu and Nkikizweni, the excitement and fear of coming to Johannesburg, the tempests of the Youth League, the endless delays of the treason trial, the drama of Rivonia. It was like a waking dream, and I attempted to transfer it to paper as simply and truthfully as I could. Mac ingeniously hid the transcribed version of the manuscript inside the binding of a number of notebooks he used for his studies. In this way, he was able to safeguard the entire text from the authorities and smuggle it out when he was released in 1976. The arrangement was that Mac would secretly communicate when the manuscript was safely out of the country. Only then would we destroy the original. In the meantime, we still had to dispose of a 500-page manuscript. We did the only thing we could do. We buried it in the garden in the courtyard. Surveillance in the courtyard had become careless and sporadic. The warders usually sat in an office at the northern end, talking among themselves. From that office, they could not see the southern end next to the isolation area where there was a small garden. I had casually inspected this area on my early morning walks, and it was there that I decided to bury the manuscript. In order not to have to dig a great hole, we decided to bury the manuscript in 3 separate places. We divided it into 2 smaller segments and 1 larger one, wrapped each in plastic, and placed them inside empty cocoa containers. The work would have to be done quickly, and I asked Jeff Massimola to fashion some digging tools. Within a few days, I was equipped with several sharp iron stakes. One morning, after breakfast, Kathy, Walter, Eddie Daniels, and I drifted over to the garden at the southern end of the courtyard, where we appeared to be having a political discussion. We were each hiding portions of the manuscript in our shirts. At a signal from me, we dropped down and began digging. I dug in the center, near a manhole cover that led to a drain pipe. When I reached the pipe, I carved out a space beneath it, and it was there that I placed the largest of the three containers. The others dug two shallower holes for their portions. We finished just in time to line up for our march to the quarry. As I walked that morning, I felt a sense of relief that the manuscript was safely hidden. I then thought no more about it. A few weeks later, just after our wake-up call, I heard a sound in the courtyard that made me uneasy. It was the thud of picks and shovels on the ground. When we were allowed out of our cells for wash-up, I walked to the front of the corridor and managed to peer out the door and around the corner. There, at the south end of the courtyard, was a work crew from the general section. To my alarm, they were digging in the area where the manuscript was buried. The authorities had decided to build a wall in front of the isolation section because they had discovered that the prisoners in isolation were able to communicate with us in the courtyard. The work crew was digging a shallow trench for the concrete foundation of the wall. While washing up, I managed to inform Walter and Kathy about the digging outside. Kathy thought that the main part of the manuscript, which was buried under the pipe, would probably be safe, but that the other two were vulnerable. When the drums of breakfast porridge were wheeled into the courtyard, the warders commanding the work crew ordered the men out of the yard. This was done to prevent any fraternization with the political prisoners. With our bowls of porridge in hand, I led Walter and Kathy over to the south end of the courtyard as though I wanted to confer with them privately. The beginnings of the trench were already perilously close to the two smaller containers. At the same time, we were joined by Eddie Daniels, who immediately recognized the problem. There was only one thing to do. As inconspicuously as possible, the four of us began digging in the area where the two smaller pieces of manuscript would be. We managed to unearth the two containers rather quickly and covered the area again with soil. To rescue the chunk of manuscript under the pipe would require more time, but we were confident that they would not find the manuscript because they would not dislodge the pipe in order to build the wall. We hid the manuscript in our shirts as we walked back to our cells. Eddie was not going to the quarry that day, and we gave the containers to him, instructing him to destroy them as soon as possible. At great personal risk, Eddie agreed to do so. I breathed easier, knowing that we had salvaged the two containers, and tried not to dwell on the remaining piece of manuscript as I worked that day. When we returned from the quarry that afternoon, instead of washing up, which I normally did, I strolled over to the far end of the courtyard. I attempted to appear as casual as possible, but I was alarmed by what I saw. The prisoners had dug a trench that ran parallel to the wall of the isolation section and had actually removed the pipe altogether. They could not help but have uncovered the manuscript. I must have flinched or reacted in some way that was noticeable. Unknown to me, I was being watched by a number of warders, who later said that my reaction confirmed that I knew a manuscript had been there. I returned to the corridor to wash up and told Walter and Kathy that I suspected the manuscript had been discovered. Eddie had meanwhile successfully disposed of the other two pieces. Early the next morning, I was summoned to the office to see the commanding officer. Next to him stood a high prison official who had just arrived from Pretoria. Without any greeting whatsoever, the commanding officer announced, "Mandela, we have found your manuscript." I did not reply. The commanding officer then reached behind his desk and produced a sheaf of papers. "This is your handwriting, is it not?" he demanded. Again, I remained silent. "Mandela," the commander said in some exasperation, "we know this is your work." "Well," I replied, "you must produce some proof of that." They scoffed at this and said they knew the notations in the margin were made by Walter Sisulu and Ahmed Kathrada. Again, I said that they must furnish evidence if they were going to impose any penalties. We do not need evidence, the commander said. We have the evidence. Although he did not impose a penalty that day, a short while later, Walter, Kathy, and I were called before General Rue, the deputy commissioner of prisons, who told us that we had abused our study privileges in order to illegally write the manuscript. For that offense, our study privileges were being suspended indefinitely. As it turned out, we lost study privileges for 4 years. After Mac was released in December, he sent the notebooks overseas to England. He spent the next 6 months under house arrest in South Africa before slipping out of the country and going first to Lusaka to see Oliver and then to London. He stayed there for 6 months. With a typist, he reconstructed the manuscript and put together a typescript. He then returned to Lusaka and presented Oliver with a copy. From there, the trail grows cold. I heard nothing from Lusaka about the manuscript and still do not know precisely what Oliver did with it. Although it was not published while I was in prison, it forms the spine of this memoir. Chapter 79. In 1976, I received an extraordinary visit. Jimmy Kruger, the Minister of Prisons, a prominent member of the Prime Minister's Cabinet, came to see me. Kruger was not only influential about prisons policy, but he was critical to the government's handling of the liberation struggle. I had an inkling as to why he had come. The government was then engaged in a massive effort to make a success of its separate development policy and quasi-independent homelands. The showpiece of separate development was the Transkei, led by my nephew and one-time benefactor K.D. Matanzima, who had successfully repressed almost all legitimate opposition to his rule. I recalled that the commanding officer had recently said to me in a bantering way, "Mandela, you ought to retire to the Transkei and take a good long rest." As it turned out, that was precisely what Jimmy Kruger was proposing as well. He was a stout, blunt man, not nearly as polished as I would have expected from a cabinet minister. I approached the meeting as another opportunity to present our grievances, and at first he seemed content to listen. I began by reminding him of the letter we had sent him in 1969, which had gone unanswered. He merely shrugged. I then detailed the poor conditions on the island, reiterating once more that we were political prisoners, not criminals, and expected to be treated as such. But Kruger scoffed at this, saying, "Nah, you are all violent communists." I then began to tell him a bit about the history of our organization and why we had turned to violence. It was clear that he knew almost nothing about the ANC, and what he did know was gleaned from the propaganda of the right-wing press. When I told him the organization was far older than the National Party, he was dumbfounded. I said that if he considered us communists, he should reread the Freedom Charter. He looked at me blankly. He had never heard of the Freedom Charter. I found it extraordinary that a cabinet minister should be so uninformed. Yet I should not have been surprised. Nationalist politicians routinely condemned what they didn't understand. I raised the question of our release and reminded him of the case of the 1914 Afrikaner rebels who had resorted to violence, though they were represented in parliament, could hold meetings, and could even vote. Even though General De Wet and General Kemp had led a force of 12,000 and occupied towns and caused many deaths, they were both released soon after their convictions for high treason. I mentioned the case of Robbie Lebrandt, who set up an underground organization during the Second World War to oppose South Africa's support for the Allies. He was sentenced to life imprisonment but soon pardoned. Kruger seemed as ignorant of these episodes in the history of his own people as he was of the Freedom Charter. It is difficult to negotiate with those who do not share the same frame of reference. Kruger waved all of this aside. "This is ancient history," he said. He came armed with a specific offer. Despite his reputation for brusqueness, he made his proposal in a deferential manner. He stated the matter simply. If I recognized the legitimacy of the Transkei government and was willing to move there, my sentence would be dramatically reduced. I listened respectfully until he had finished. First, I said, I wholly rejected the Bantustan policy and would do nothing to support it. And second, I was from Johannesburg, and it was to Johannesburg that I would return. Kruger remonstrated with me, but to no avail.